This RFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, it's Peloton Playlist.
Colors pop, the beat is tight. Brush strokes, dancing morning light. Tune it up, the vibe's just right. We're alive, jump in the groove where art and songs collide. Tune it up, the vibe's just right.
Yes, it's Peloton Playlist, and welcome to the Untrained Eye and Ear Show. If you're a regular listener, and we know there's a few of you out there, I don't have an intro this week. I'm just going to riff this. I'm excited. This is great because this is our first one back where it's the three of us for 2026.
Yay.
Sarah's been to America.
And she made it back.
I did.
And
I
she
survived.
Made it back. Yeah. She didn't get intercepted at the border.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. This is exciting. Kane's been to Whanganui.
And Wainui Mata.
And Wainui Mata.
And I made it back.
And you made it back.
Good work.
They let him back in at the border.
Yes, that's right.
And I've been to Dannyburg a few times, but we'll leave that there. So today's show is about the untrained eye and ear. So this is people working in and around art and music who may not have gone through traditional channels or expected channels to learn their craft, and I guess that's one of the things, right? Especially like in the art world, you've got quite an established pattern that people would often follow to earn their almost like their chops before they make it, so to speak. And in music, well, certainly we're in a time now where people are able to create on the fly. Quite easily at home. I may play with Suno myself. That may be our intro music, in fact. But you think back to the 70s, right, when you had all of those bands that were like highly trained musicians, the Pink Floyds, those sorts of
things. There's always that other side of the coin, though, isn't there? And when you start scratching away at the surface, you find some really interesting examples.
Yeah.
We will dive into, you know, I'm going right back to the 30s for one of my tracks, just to sort of talk about that and how it came about, what have you. Yeah. So, yeah.
I thought you were in your 30s last week, mate.
It's been a little while.
How old are you now? Do we talk about that on air?
Well, I have had a birthday since our last show.
Have you had a birthday since your last show?
Happy birthday.
I am now 47.
47?
Yes, which means I'm closer to 50 than I ever have been.
That is very true. That is very true. I am as close to 50 as I am to 60, shall we say.
Nice.
I'm also as close to 50 as I've ever been, but I'm also much closer to 40.
No need to show off.
Yeah, I know. No. Always one.
That's why your knees don't creak as you walk up the stairs.
Yeah.
I love that we're all skiting about being 40 plus.
This is the 40 plus show. Tune in, kids. Right. Let's start. Since Sarah's been away, I think we should start with art today.
Sure, happy to.
Where would you like to begin?
Well, I thought we'd start with, I mean, as you said, there's a pathway to art that most people accept these days, which is art school. And thinking about, well, that hasn't always been the case. The first art school was actually not until the late 1500s, which Vasari started. But he was inspired by, he's the late Renaissance or the Renaissance figures. So I thought we'd start with, well, what did arts education or what was your pathway to being an artist before the art school path exists? And I was thinking about, I mean, I love the Renaissance is something I've studied a bit. So I started there because it's just like any trade apprenticeship was the way you did it. You found someone or your family was connected to someone who was in the arts and they taught you how to do it. It was a craft. It was a skill. It wasn't sort of this more esoteric thing that it is these days. It was very much, no, this is a profession I am entering. So the person I wanted to talk about was Donatello. And I promise you, he is not a teenage turtle.
Dang it.
I was expecting a teenage turtle to pop up right then.
But he is the strangest one to have as one of the turtles, because he predates a lot of the he's actually a couple of generations away from the other turtles. But the reason he gets mentioned alongside Michelangelo and Raphael and Leonardo is because he was probably the most influential early Renaissance artist. He was taught by Ghiberti, who is one of my favourite artists, but I don't know if many people know him. But if you've been to Florence and you've seen the gates of paradise, then you've seen, well, replicas, because the real ones aren't on the doors.
You're getting blank stares from Kane and I.
But they're amazing relief sculptures. So he was taught by Ghiberti. But then what Donatello did is the image I've got up, if you're watching, is of his David, from which he made between 1435 and 1440. And what he brought was this layer of realism of that just wasn't really seen before. And he was, you know, as all artists in Florence, was working with Medici's, because everyone was. But then he, of course, became established after working with Ghiberti, had his own practice. And then he took on students or apprentices. His probably, most people don't know who this artist is, but Bertoldo di Giovanni was one of his probably most important students. But he was not necessarily important because of who he was, but he was important because of who his student was, which was Michelangelo. So, and then you've got Leonardo was very heavily influenced by Donatello. So this idea that you're living within a rubric, a sort of a what we now call a school. It's interesting the way that we call them, we've sort of put the school name on what they did. So you'll see, sorry, from this time period, if people can't tell who made something, because often in these studio systems, these apprenticeship systems, you had artists who were working on other people's art. So you'd have one of the painters, but then his students would have worked on the paintings as well. And if you can't tell who exactly did it, you can usually tell whose style they were working in. So you'll say the school of Donatello, because it's probably not Donatello, but it was someone who was heavily influenced by him, maybe one of his actual students, or maybe someone who was working within that similar time period with those same ideas. So I was just, I'm constantly fascinated by the way in which we change sort of the bar about how people work and what we consider the education system when it comes to the arts, because we're at another kind of period where people are questioning what does the right, quote-unquote, right arts education look like. I'll talk further and some other things about kind of the, because I've always got to bring the mood down a little bit at some stage during one of these talks, talk about sort of the problematic ideas about arts education. But I thought starting with Donatello and starting with the idea of that you were working in almost a guild-like system, you were working with other people to do your own art, and then if you were one of the ones who was really successful, then you'd move on and build your own system of making around it. And this David is probably Donatello's most famous work outside of being a ninja turtle.
Besides that, and I note, I assume that you're right there, Kane.
I just can't stop thinking about ninja turtles.
That's fair enough. Well, I was just going to say that clearly this sculpture was after Michelangelo's, because by the time he did this, David could afford a hat, and there's not a hat in the Michelangelo one.
Yeah, but the Michelangelo one is much bigger, so.
So he shrunk. See, he shrunk, and he could afford a hat.
Well, the weird thing about the Michelangelo is David, is that you, where it is in the gallery, it is in Florence, you can go up and see it higher, but that's not the way it's designed. Because if you do that, you see how the anatomy is all wrong, because it was made, designed to be looked up at. So the arms are elongated, the hands are much bigger than they should be, because you want to, he wanted you to look up at it and see the perspective. It's a big thing about the Renaissance, so really introducing perspective and getting body movements. It's why the big thing about the Donatello's David is the S shape of the body. That's what was quite revolutionary. Rather than a static straight up and down, there was movement to the sculpture that there wasn't in a lot of other sculptures before that.
Cool. And speaking of straight up and down individuals.
Hey. Well, so just going back to the hat before we move on. You know, odd choice of battle gear, right? Sword, there's some armour down by the feet, you've got some boots and a sun hat. Otherwise naked.
Well, yes, but you know, can be quite dangerous out there on those when the UV rays are high on those battlefields. So points for wearing a hat.
Yeah, probably some other bits you might want to cover.
Honestly, partly it's probably because the Renaissance was very obsessed with ancient Greek and Greece and Rome. So they were basing it on, yes, a lot of those ancient Greek and Roman statues were clothed, but also, you know, the original Olympians were nude for most of, like, for the wrestling and things like that.
You can't compete covered in olive oil. It's not real sport.
But also, how can you show off that you can get anatomy right?
Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah. That's true. And obviously, it was a cold day.
Creepers. Can we just talk about Ninja Turtles again?
Yeah, are the Ninja Turtles wearing clothes?
No, because they're in a half shell. They're turtles. They're nude.
So they're wearing their houses.
They're travelling folk. Now look, this started its life as a serious show about music and art, and then we came back after Christmas and...
Don't pretend that it was ever serious.
No, that's true. That's true. It's never been serious. That's the right point. But Michael hasn't realised it yet, so that's why we're still on air.
Wonderful.
Where are you going today, Kane?
Right, talking about those untrained ears and untrained hands, maybe even somewhat... My first thoughts mingled around, and I thought, oh, do I go in this direction? Do I go in that direction? And so I've gone in two directions, and we'll start in the very left of centre direction. And the first person I want to speak about is someone that's been quite influential, especially on late 80s, early 90s alternative music scenes. So this chap, Daniel Johnson, was a massive outside artist. He was creating his own works, with very dubious musical skills, but his lyrical prowess is quite notable, and his he's very solemn in the way he talks about things. He did suffer terribly from different mental health issues, which sort of affected his career, and you can see how he progressed and what some of his songs tackle. And the song I've chosen because of that sort of side of things is not his most famous song, which was called True Love Will Find You in the End, which is, it's a bit of a tearjerker. It's quite a hard listen. But this song's called Monster Inside of Me. But Daniel Johnson was championed by artists such as Sonic Youth. Kurt Cobain cited Daniel Johnson, massive influence. And if you listen to Kurt Cobain's early solo home recordings that he did, you can just, there's a bit of emulation there in some ways, even though, you know, Kurt had his own demons he was fighting from day dot. So, I think we should just go straight into Daniel Johnson's Monster Inside of Me and just hear someone who had no formal training and just created their own art.
At me, you see the monster in my eyes. If you could only help me, girl, we could be in paradise, be happy ever after, and there would be no more tears. Eternal peace is what I'm after. Maybe, girl, you could help me understand the monster inside of me. that I want you. You can see that I need you, but you hate the monster. Well, honey, I do too. I need your love to carry me out of the darkness of the pit. You know I feel just like shit. Maybe, girl, you could help me fight the monster inside of me. Maybe if someone had said to Vincent Van Gogh, keep punching Joe, maybe he'd be here today. Maybe he'd be here today. You inspire the strength within, and I can be conqueror as my spirit rise above us. Maybe, girl, you could help me destroy the monster inside of me. And we could
Daniel Johnson. That's really interesting.
It is. I wholly recommend having a little dive into his back catalogue. There's a lot of work. Yeah, really prolific artist and, yeah, fascinating.
How did the artist who championed him discover his work?
That is a really good question. I think he got picked up by a small label and produced a couple of albums. And he did his own artwork, cover artwork, and all that sort of thing as well. So it's yeah, it's quite interesting to look at visually as well. Very basic, very naive.
Mm.
But yeah, I don't know how exactly they found him. But I remember as a young guy being a kid who skateboarded in the late 80s, early 90s, and they had adverts for Daniel Johnson music in these skateboarding magazines. So obviously he was in the underground somewhere, but we're getting enough sort of recognition for the record companies to sort of throw an ad here and there. And yeah, it was, he's fascinating, very fascinating.
Yeah, it was really, really interesting. I really liked it.
Cool.
Yeah. And because it's interesting you're talking about skateboarding, because I'm like, that song, I have trouble like associating with like skateboarding. I have other music in my head when I think about skateboarding as
well.
Yeah, well, saying,
you know,
right?
in skateboarding magazines for that time, you're looking at a lot of hardcore punk.
Yeah.
It's the rise of the Red Hot Chili Peppers in their first format as a, you know, punk's reggae band.
Yep.
You know, and the early days of the Seattle scene, and they're all that sort of stuff's filtering through. And then you have Daniel Johnson and the people that, you know, like Sonic Youth, they were always in the skateboard magazine as well, and they're just noisemakers, you know,
lo-fi
noisemakers, which doesn't really relate, but obviously they felt a connection to his sort of lo-fi, self-producing attitude.
Yeah.
And in a way, I guess it is kind of a punk record, isn't it? You know, he wasn't going into a record with all his big production skills. It's him and his piano and his interesting songwriting formulas.
Yeah, I mean, it's very true, isn't
no
it?
No formula.
No, yeah.
He's just getting it out, isn't he? He's just making it.
Because it's, yeah, because you're right. Like, so in our heads, when we say punk, we think of the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Damned, those sorts of bands. But actually, if you pull away the layers of what they're trying to do in that music, then actually this is that sort of stuff. It just doesn't have all that noise with it that we're used to.
Yeah, and punk was enveloped in a cloud of marketing, right?
Indeed. Thank you, Malcolm McLaren.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, punk is one of the things I did want to talk about a little bit later on. Just, you know, it was the DIY aesthetic. It's anyone can make a record.
Yeah.
You don't have to be signed to a big label, even though that's where the money was. And, you know, Malcolm McLaren, that's what he wanted. He wanted the money and he wanted the infamy. So,
yeah.
But you get so much more in the punk scene from then onwards. It was sort of that initial impetus.
Excellent. All right. Where do we go from there in the art scene?
Well, I think it's interesting to see how aligned both of them are, and that I was thinking about, well, what is outsider art in the art context? And probably the most famous outsider artist is Henri Rousseau. He's a French painter. And he was working in the date is wrong on the one that I've got up, so I apologise. He was working in the late 19th century to the very early 20th century. And he had no training. He was, one of his nicknames in the art world was what translates to the customs officer, because that's what his day job was. He wasn't really, didn't really start painting until he was in his 40s. But you start thinking, well, if someone is truly an outsider artist, which means that they're not from the traditional art world, they don't have the traditional story of how an artist gets there, they don't have the training, they don't have the connections, they don't have the polished work that we associate with the art world, how do we know about him? And it's through established artists. So one of his biggest proponents, and he was Pablo Picasso. And while he was known in the 19th century, it was in the early 20th century that he really became embraced by the art world. So there was a party that Henri and Picasso were the sort of the guests of honour at, which had all the people of the time. It's, you know, Gertrude Stein was there, kind of thing. And sort of Henri announced it that they were the two greatest contemporary painters. And part of the reason that people like Picasso, who has the very traditional story of being educated in the art world, going through all the quote-unquote right ways to do it, but he was working in a time when they started to realise that the academic approach to art kind of bound you to rules, and they wanted to break those rules, see what it is to become an insider who has an outsider perspective. So someone like Picasso started thinking about that through the lens of what was then called primitivism, which is basically what it was, is him looking at African art, and really tied up with problematic ideas about what arts from other cultures is, that it's somehow, you know, you're connected to a, like the issue that I have and a lot of other people have with the way in which artists who work in these kind of modes, who are outsiders, is that they're framed in a kind of patronising way, if that, oh, your work is childlike or unsophisticated. And those of us who are, the people who are sophisticated, look at it and being like, oh, that's interesting because it's unsophisticated, rather than it being, it's interesting because we respect you as a peer. It's tight. It's really complicated, but I do recommend people look at more of Rousseau's work, because there is something really fascinating about it. The one that I've got up here is A Tropical Forest with Monkeys, which is part of the National Gallery in America. And it is really fascinating because Rousseau made up a lot of his artwork. He did also, interestingly, paint a lot of French scenes, but in the late 1890s, he started painting a lot of jungle scenes. He never left France. He tried to pretend he did, and part of that pretending was in his paintings. And so he'd paint these particularly exotic tropical environments that are based on him going to botanical gardens in Paris and reading magazines and things like that. So there's this extra level of naivety in the work that the people in the early 20th century loved, because he not only was not connected to the art world, but he was also trying to connect with what they saw as a, you know, a more natural environment, even though he had no connection to the natural environment. But it was also the reason that there's this, especially in this late 19th century, early 20th century, is probably the biggest, almost all of the naive artists that we know, that are more well internationally known and known from that period, because the it's interesting how one or two people can make that happen. It's because, and that's because the director of the Museum of Modern Art in New York had a particular interest in naive or outsider art. So they had a lot of exhibitions and started collecting a lot of work from that period. It's part of the reason he lost his job eventually, because they were like, you're actually not telling any other, like, you're not telling enough of the other histories of art. But yeah, it means I have this sort of complicated idea in my mind about, it's just that thing of, are people liking it for the right reasons? Or are they liking it because they think that it's, you know, you know, thinking that this artist is somehow, you know, a lot of the outside artists have mental health issues, have things that you're just like, oh, is this happening? Are you helping this person in the right way? It's, yeah, complicated. But I also think that Rousseau's paintings on a broader spectrum, I think if you see a body of work of his, are really interesting. His sense of colour and the paint application, the way he like flattens but not doesn't flatten his planes, is really interesting. He's got an incredible one he has of this tree-lined, yes, tree-lined sort of like avenue with rugby players in it. It's just, there's like these weird things happening that you're just like, this, everything looks like a dream. It looks like it's not reality.
And it's interesting, right? Because, I mean, not knowing previous to this any of the backstory around Rousseau, when I look at that piece of art, my first reaction is, it's actually quite a complex piece of art, and I would probably assume that he did come through a formal channel.
Yeah, it's also one of those things that it's just like, with music and with art, that a formal education can be really useful, especially for it giving you a grounding in the history of art. But also, there's no workaround for just practicing, doing it over and over and over and over again until you become good. There's no shortcut to that. There's no education that gets you there any faster than actually just doing it over and over again.
And I guess one of the issues with like the schools or that formal thing is, right, you can run down the road of art starting to look the same because people are being trained in the same things.
And I also think it's why there's this, for a lot of art educators, there's this this moment, especially in child, when you're teaching art to children, where their art is truly incredible, but then they get self-conscious about the rules and it becomes bad.
Yep.
And I think a lot of artists are trying to get back to when they didn't have that level of sort of, they're not as worried, they want to break the rules a bit more, but which is why I think outsider artists get fetishized a bit, because that people feel like, oh, they've tapped into that childhood connection to just making.
And there's that thing too, like the backing the underdog, you know, like seeing them as that person.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting too, you know, what you're saying, because there is that thing in art, right? So when you're talking about people not necessarily appreciating art for what it is, when something becomes vogue and people just start buying a particular artist with no real eye on whether the particular painting or sculpture is pleasing to them or not, or has what merit it has or not, they're buying it because they think they should buy it.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is that it's just, and also how, when I'm working with artists, I say it's interesting to see what people will think of your work, the work you're making now, in 5 years' time, because sometimes people don't know how to deal or understand something until they see more of it, until it becomes visually normalized for them. And that's the history of art, is, you know, especially the history of modernism and abstraction, is that the shock of the new until it becomes so. These days, it's why you'd look at work and say, my child could do that. That's not the case of when most of the stuff was starting to be made. No child would ever think about making that work.
Yep.
because it simply was never done.
Mm. And that's the thing, the difference, right? The difference between thought and technique.
Yeah.
And the element of thought and creation. And that in the development of any of those schools, right, when people changed particular art or moved it in a way coming from the intellectual of a human being, not from just the fact that a child can make three strokes or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Mr. Harris, you with us still?
Yeah.
I should, hold on, I'll bring us back.
Bring us back.
Look at that. Look Wonderful. At that. Where would you like to go? And I think that what we should do is actually, you should do two in a row.
Two in a row?
Two in a row.
I've only got one more work, so I wasn't going to say that, I was just going to let it go.
I know, you'll have a two in a row and a two in a row.
You're right.
How see where I'm going?
Yeah. So I've, for my next slice, I have chosen an artist who I really love. This guy was a fan of early rock and roll. And he was sort of rural America, and he didn't know what he was hearing wasn't made by one person. So he became a rock and roll one man band. This man is called Hazel Adkins. And that his output is wild. It's the stuff he creates is fantastic. Hugely influential on bands such as The Cramps, Southern Culture on the Skids. He actually ended up performing with them later on. He created a sort of early output and then disappeared off the face of the earth because, you know, music changed and things developed. And then in the late 70s, he was rediscovered. I can't remember what he was doing. He was a mechanic or something simple like that. And people came knocking on his door to find out what he was up to and why wasn't he making music anymore. And he was like, well, because no one wants to listen to it. That's why. So he was not successful in his original phase, but then got that support yet again through other artists bringing him up and highlighting him to the world. So the track I've chosen for Hazel Adkins is called She Said. Strap in, because this is a banger of a wild rockabilly from the 50s.
So you don't want to do two in a row? You want to introduce them?
I want to come back to the next one.
You want to come back to me? Okay. Yeah. All right. So,
is it something else?
Excellent. So I looked at that for ages and I thought, is it Hazel or is it?
It's Hazel.
Hazel. So there you go. Here's Hazel.
Adkins.
Adkins, not Atkins.
Nope, not Atkins. No,
with She Said.
Well, I've got to tell you what happened. I went out last night and I got hitched up. When I woke up this morning, should have seen what I had in the bed with me. He jumped up out of bed, pulled his hand down his eye, looked at me like a guy in Canada that commodity meat. He said, so this time we're way off yet. We got all along. Thing was going just right. She jumped out of the car. She put her hand down her eye. She looked at me like a dying box of them now, and she said, so this time went away up yet. No, we did. Went away there, yeah. Got all along. They were sound like me.
And we're back.
Because that was at the end of that one.
That was the end of that track. We were just moving on to the next track.
I'll leave you. I'll leave Atkins. That up to everyone to interpret what Hazel might have been singing about then, and how he was playing his instruments all at the same time. But he did it, and I wholly recommend having a little look into his back catalogue as well. My favourite song of his is there's actually two. One of them's called Chicken Walk, it's a great song, and another one called No More Hot Dogs.
No More Hot Dogs.
I love it.
There's something in that for all of us.
Yes, that's right. Cool. My next track is, I love to add a little bit of Kiwi flavour in here, so I did a bit of digging, and I found this artist, who is actually someone I have crossed paths with in the past, but they don't want to be known that this is part of their output. So it tells you how good it must be. No.
Indeed.
It's good fun. This is someone that I know who has created two albums under the name Rotate the Completer. And it's made and recorded on a dictaphone. So it's very DIY.
Oh, cool.
It's a bit, you know, hit and miss. It's all over the place. But it's very, very primal music. And this track is the first song off the first album, which is called Rotate the Completer, the Completed Works, even though there is a second album. And there's plenty of tongue in cheek. And a track is called One.
Rotate the Completer.
Wasn't that fun?
And one. It was interesting. No one can ever say that the music that gets played in here isn't interesting.
I like it in that you that we're so used to the structure of songs that you can just turn your brain off, but with something like that you're just like, oh no, everything is unexpected. You're not sure what's going to come next.
Absolutely. There's no verse, chorus, verse on that one.
Yeah.
It's just
because it's very much, it's that cultural thing, right? Like it's like when Western people find, say, like Japanese music challenging because it works in different ways to what we're used to. And this is exactly the same concept, right? Somebody's not following the Western European, this is how a song goes.
Yeah, especially in the 20th century, there is such a rigid, like, no, this is how a song is constructed for consumption.
Yeah. Mm. Must follow this scale, must follow this pattern.
Yeah. This is, you know, very, very wild comparison, but I do love those songs that do succeed in that space when they don't follow the rules as well.
Do you have an example?
One of my favourites from the 60s era would be Jefferson Airplane and White Rabbit.
White Rabbit, yeah.
Yeah, it's just a song. It's basically just a poem.
Yeah, indeed.
There's no return to anything.
With some music in the background. Yeah,
it's great. And it's iconic for them.
Yeah, indeed. Some would argue, me, that's probably their best track. But, you know.
Well, you're not far off, sure. Yeah, got a few good ones.
Good ones, one or two, you know. But, you know, some could be better than others.
Oh, for everyone's outfit, right? You know, song two from Rotate the Completer might be your cup of tea more than number one. But,
Well, I do like Song 2 by Blur.
They're a very different song.
Very different song. Possibly following the rules a bit more.
Yes, very much so.
You know, hey. All right, it's art time.
Yep. So I've been very busy lately, so that's why I've only got three works. But we're installing exhibitions at the moment, and thinking about, you know, trained versus untrained, I realised that in the main gallery, we're installing an exhibition by sort of to almost like to equally good, but almost opposite. And that, the one I'm not talking about is Caroline Macquarie, who, she is, I wouldn't say like an academic artist, but she is also an artist who works within an academic framework because she's literally an art school teacher. And on the other side, we have who I am going to talk about today, which is Lisa Nelson, who is a local artist who is almost entirely self-taught. She's a photographer. The sort of the calling card image for this exhibition, which is called A Still Life, but the calling card work is A Bowl of Yellow Roses. And she's an incredible photographer who's also working within the history of art, and that, you know, that a still life is part of the history of art. But she, with certain aspects of this exhibition, is also complicating that history of art by having her own photograph, the still life she has created and photographed in front of a painting that looks very similar to the still life that she has created. So Bowl of Yellow Roses has behind it, as its background, a painting by another artist called Lily Hogg, who we know almost nothing about other than that she did show her work a few times. It's the classic kind of work that you find for, you know, $5 to $15 at an op shop that you have no context for who owned it, where it's come from, how it got into their collection. It's sort of on its own. And what she had, what Lisa has done through this body of work is, not with all of the objects, but with some of them, bringing in that history of art within it. But also equally interesting having that, because Lisa herself is self-taught, she's gotten to this stage of her practice simply by doing that, practicing. Working in a small studio with her camera, with a backdrop, and just with a lot of her work, she photographs it multiple times throughout the day. She only works in natural light, so a lot of it is figuring out with this work, what time of day do I think it looks best photographed in? But also how she has achieved success is by how a lot of self-taught artists have achieved success, and that is by putting herself out there, putting her work into exhibitions, putting her work into, and also creating a community around herself of other artists. I think people have this idea that artists exist, especially visual artists, exist as sort of on their own in their studio, and that's it. Whereas I don't know a single artist who is successful who hasn't got a cohort of people around them who they can bounce ideas off of, they can commiserate with, celebrate with, who can give them insight into, oh, have you tried doing this with your work or doing that? So sort of as much as we've gotten rid of the idea of the guild system in visual arts, there are most artists are creating those sort of schools, even if they don't have the traditional schooling. Because I think with a lot of particularly young artists who come out of art school, they find it really hard when they first come out because they're so used to having a whole bunch of people around them who can they can bounce ideas off of. And in fact, a lot of them find that they need a few years after art school to get that out of their system until they build their own sort of structure for how to work. What I find interesting about today is as much as art school is still probably predominantly the way in which most artists become established, there is an opening up of realizing, particularly as we understand that that is a very Western notion of how to do things, that this singular way of saying this is the correct path just isn't the reality in contemporary life.
Cool. I think it's brilliant. You've included a piece by Lisa in terms of, you know, being a local artist. Exhibition about to open.
Yes, this week, next Friday night, it opens.
Indeed. And, I mean, it's the stuff I love about her work is just, I mean, the light on the objects that she's photographing is always so exquisite. And you look at it and you go, is it a painting? Is it a photograph? And you try and decipher that, which is cool.
There's a couple of works in the show which it is really hard to tell what is the painting and what is her work. But she also does it with fabrics as well. A lot of her work in this exhibition is also about the sort of overlooked domestic environments, particularly from a woman's point of view. And so there are also actual textiles and wallpapers in the exhibition. So I'm really excited about it. It's been so much fun to hang the last few days. I've still got a few more things to do on it, but it's looking beautiful.
Awesome.
And it always helps when the person's really nice. Indeed. Lisa's lovely.
It always helps.
I do encourage people next, not this Saturday, but next Saturday, she's giving a talk. Awesome. So is Caroline, and they're both fabulous artists. So 10:30, come along.
And you were talking about the fact that Lisa's surrounded herself with other creatives. Are those people photographers as well, or is it more multidisciplinary in terms?
Multidisciplinary, because I think these days people, artists aren't siloing themselves. I imagine it's a little bit the same with music, that very few musicians are, well, there are some who are just like, this is my genre and that's it. But they're realizing, I actually know the history of music is borrowing from all different kinds of genres. And if you just limit yourself to one mode of making, you're not allowing yourself to be inspired by other things or to evolve your work.
Absolutely. There's so many artists have gone on to, you know, from what they're best known for to become creative. The example that comes straight to my mind is Paul Simon, right? Graceland is one of his standout albums. And it was a massive departure from Simon and Garfunkel and the early singles that he produced as a solo artist, but involving, you know, indigenous populations and recording using their rhythms and that sort of thing gave him a whole new life and really changed his career direction.
So you've just made me think of another question just relating to Lisa, because you said Paul Simon, and of course one of his solo tracks was Kodachrome.
Indeed.
Does Lisa work digital or analog?
Digital.
Right.
She's one of the first people to say she's too modest about her work. And she'll be the first one to say that she doesn't have the technical knowledge around photography the way someone who has gone through the traditional modes of making is. But I think she really proves you, through practice, through doing it over and over again, you can find the way of working with your material mode of making in a way that works for you.
Cool. All right, Kane, we might only have time for one more song.
Eek.
If you had to choose, would you choose number 4 or number 5?
Oh, I want to say number five, but I'm going to go number four because it's one of the greatest mythologies in music
right.
that exists to this day.
So we'll go there in a minute because I've got a question first.
Good.
This is, you know, one of our questions.
Oh, yikes.
That we have.
Oh, no.
just the way it is, really. But I also did want to pick up on the fact, I don't know if you picked up on it, but I picked up on the inference before, yeah, when Sarah said that she's only got three items today because she's been really busy. And you turned up with six.
Yeah, but they're all really
awkward.
Short.
Awkward.
They're all really short, Cara. Most of them are only 2 minutes, 30 song.
Just saying. I thought, brutal. Oh, she's having a go.
That's it. Next week, we're just doing 8 minute long songs.
Yeah. 1 minute. Epic. Oh, you're playing Pink Floyd.
The epics. Yeah. No Pink Floyd.
Oh,
sans Pink Floyd.
Sans Pink Floyd. Cool. So my question, nice and simple and easy one for you. What for you was the highlight of what you did over your summer break? What was the best thing or, you know?
My best thing was spending New Year's Eve in a hockey arena in Cincinnati, Ohio, where there were two fights. It went to overtime. The home team won, and then they set off fireworks inside.
And, you know, if you...
America!
Yeah.
And if you knew Sarah, you would not think that that was what she would say, right? But the highlight of my life was basically a fight on ice with some fireworks.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's excellent.
I loved it.
It's
loved excellent. It. So, and it wasn't seeing the Andy Warhol painting at
thank you.
Indianapolis Art Museum.
We nearly got away with it.
I know. I'm sorry.
You couldn't do it. You see, this is the thing. I've embedded
He's
Andy Warhol
me.
So deep. Now, if Sarah's
feels
worried,
wrong. It feels like we can't finish.
Indeed, if she thinks we're going to get to the end of the show, she has to bring up Warhol herself. I don't even have to do it anymore. It's brilliant.
So good.
We've come a long way from that intro thing that we did with Andy when we recorded it, and Michael expertly put it together and
Absolutely.
Made us sound amazing.
Absolutely. So just to be the yang or the yin to Sarah's yang or yin.
Ning to the nong.
Yeah, that's right. You know, while you have got this really rock and roll story, mine would be the successful making of buttercream icing for the first time in my life. So many times I have failed at making freaking buttercream icing. I baked my wife a birthday cake because it was her birthday in early January, and it was a lovely little walnut cake, and I made successful buttercream icing. Cha-ching! Happy as.
Nice work.
It's ridiculously hard to make good, proper buttercream.
You know, I did a little happy dance in the kitchen. You know, it's not watching someone get punched out on ice with fireworks, but, you know, to me, so amazing.
I like you guys, you're breaking all the rules, which is great. You know, there's no stereotypes going on in here. Yeah.
What about you? What was your highlight?
Oh, thanks for asking. I was wondering if anybody was going to ask. you know, it's always just that moment. You just wonder. I think, so it was my birthday over the break. So the 30th of December was my birthday. And we went out for dinner, and I'm going to regret starting this story because I can't remember the name of the place. So the place which is in the old bank in Martinborough on the corner, which has gin as well. Starts with a K. I'm
just going to smile and nod.
A place. Anyway, superb meal. A really great wine list and a really nice meal. And it caused me to revise my feelings about, you know, whether it was, how easy it was to get really good dining in the Wairarapa. This blew my mind, actually.
Nice.
So that was me. Yeah, there are lots of good food establishments in the Wairarapa. I'm not slamming them, all by any stretch of the imagination.
I appreciate them more having come back from America. Lived.
indeed. But it's nice to go to a place and kind of go, actually, I wasn't expecting that.
Mm.
You know, yeah.
You should come to my house and try my buttercream icing sometime.
All right.
No, don't. Don't. The pressure will be on. It'll all go wrong. It'll be lumpy and weird.
We? All right. We've got 4 minutes.
4 minutes. Quick intro. This is an artist who has influenced more artists than you can probably shake a stick at, especially the 60s white boy blues guitarists out of the UK, and many, many guitarists that come out. This track I've chosen is Sweet Home Chicago by Robert Johnson, the first member of the 27 Club, sold his soul at the crossroads, as legend has it, and was poisoned by a jealous love. Oh, get out of town. He recorded 41 tracks over a seven-month period in the year 1936-37. That's him. Done and dusted. Dead. Gone. Rediscovered. Reissued. Becomes the cornerstone for blues rock as we know it, and would have influenced my next song as well. But, you know, Robert Johnson, it's just that early blues which you can't go past. My next track would have been Stone Free by Jimi Hendrix, who is obviously...
3 minutes, Kane.
Oh, we're going to get there. It's only... Oh, we're going to cut it off. Anyway, listen to Jimi Hendrix, listen to Robert Johnson. Have a great day, everyone. Goodbye.
Chicago.
We've been Palette and Playlist. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.